10 days after the first anniversary of the death in police custody of women's rights icon Mahsa Amini, few signs of protest emerge from Iran. We ask the Hengal Organization for Human Rights why.
Because of the militarization in Kurdistan city especially, people couldn't start any protest on that day or after September 16th.
Plus, how members of the Iranian president's delegation to the UN General Assembly reacted when approached by VOA journalists at a New York hotel.
Seeing somebody, like a journalist, asking him tough questions inside an elevator all the way to his room, I think that's one hell of an experience he's never going to forget.
And a former U.S. hostage of Iran on why last week's U.S.-Iran prisoner releases were not a prisoner exchange. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. After months of the Iranian government cracking down on peaceful dissent nationwide, the first anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death on September 16th and the 10 days that followed were relatively quiet. It was a stark contrast to the mass street protests that engulfed Iran as news of her death spread a year ago. A Europe-based research group called the Hengal Organization for Human Rights says Iran's government continued arresting its perceived critics on and after the anniversary date in the northwestern province of Kurdistan, where Amini was from, and in other regions. I spoke on the phone Tuesday with Hengal news editor Oyar Shehi and asked her what kind of protest activity her group observed in Iran on the anniversary of Amini's death.
So on the September 16th, as you say, most of the cities in Iranian Kurdistan went on the widespread strikes, like most of the shops and the stores were closed. But on the evening, we can say that on some cities like Senandaj in Kurdistan, Saqqez, and a small town named Merivan, people tried to gather and start protests, but they faced crackdowns by government forces. They directly shoot at them and they throw shotguns at them. And in Kermanshah, there were several people who were injured on that evening. Also in Rasht, it's a northern city in Iran, people started protesting and also they were facing intense crackdowns by the government forces. So we can say because of the militarization in Kurdistan city especially, that intense militarization that people couldn't start any movement on any protest on that day or after the September 16th.
What were your sources of information about the protests that happened in the Kurdistan province and elsewhere? You said that people went on strike and some people gathered in the evening. How are you able to verify that?
So we, as a Hengal Organization for Human Rights, we are an organization that we are working for almost 7 years, covering the human rights abuses in the Kurdistan and from the last year in all of Iran. Since this last years, we have our sources that have been working for us for several years. And when we receive an information, even from our sources, that's, we can rely on it. And it's always with the footage, with a photo or with videos that can be used as a proof for the news. And if we receive it from people to our channels, we try to verify it through our sources and to confirm it that way. And it's not an easy job, actually, because we cannot ourselves be there because any kind of this activities is not allowed in Iran. Like, it's a risk for our sources. And then they are volunteers who are doing this. So it's not an easy thing to actually verify our sources. But always we try to verify our sources through several sources, the information that we get, and to be sure that the thing that we are going to cover it and be like accurate that the incident happened.
What can you share with our audience about what you have seen in terms of protest activity after the anniversary date?
Well, after the anniversary date, based on our footage that we have received, I don't know if anything have happened, especially in the Kurdistan areas because of the militarization situation that still continues. And from what we are getting, even on the anniversary dates of other victims, the government forces would like raid into the house of this families. And we had an incident in the Qazvin on the family that they were trying to have anniversary for their son. And as the previous cases, the government forces conducted a raid into their residence and shot tear gas at their family members and abused and assaulted them in around their house to not let them go out of their residence to the graveyard to have any anniversary.
And what was the date of that incident and where did it happen?
It was in Qazvin, near a village in the Qazvin, and it was on September 21st.
Now, as you see the militarization that you mentioned in the Kurdistan region, with the Iranian security forces really being deployed in big numbers, apparently to try to prevent people from coming out to the streets, what do you expect to see in the coming weeks and months? How much longer do you think this kind of militarization will last?
Well, it cannot last forever, like for a long time, I would say, because there are other parts of Iran that would be expected to start protest or the anniversary date of the other victims of the nationwide protests in the last year, like in other parts of Iran. So it cannot go on for a long time. And we would expect anything happen in the anniversary dates of the other victims in Kurdistan, like in Sanandaj or in other cities, that people might go out and start protests, because obviously the militarization cannot go on for a long time because they have to transfer the forces to other parts of the Iran.
Are you able to actually talk to family members of protesters who were killed? Are you able to talk to residents of the Kurdistan region in Iran to find out, you know, how they feel about the anniversaries that are happening? Do they want to protest, but they just feel too afraid to go out to the streets?
Actually, about the victim families, I would say that's the main difference from this time's protests and from the last times, is the victims of the family are always says that the government or the Islamic Republic of Iran are the people who killed our beloved ones, and we have seen it on the burial ceremonies or the 40 days ceremony after their deaths, that they are continuously saying that they want to avenge their loved ones. They want this government goes, and we see on the burial ceremony, the son of victims and their daughter, the mothers, all of them are saying down to the regime, and this regime must go, and they are the ones who killed our sons, and always asking people to stand with them and to be their voice, to don't leave them alone. And so that's what the families want, actually.
Well, Oyar Shehhi, news editor with the Hengal Organization for Human Rights, joining us on the line from Luxembourg. Thank you very much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi returned home on September 21st from what his government described as a successful three-day visit to New York for the UN General Assembly. It made no mention of members of his delegation harassing and scuffling with journalists who approached with questions about Iran's poor rights record. One of them was Saman Arbabi of VOA's Persian service. I spoke to him by phone about what happened when he and several colleagues went through a hotel security checkpoint to try to report on a gathering of Raisi's delegation on the night of September 20th.
So we went in there with our camera people and a couple of journalists, and then we waited around the lobby for a few minutes and noticed, you know, they're coming in and they're obviously taking the elevator to whatever floor it was on. We knew it was private, so we tried to follow some of them and ask them questions, and they wouldn't answer. One of my colleagues actually was able to even get inside one of the elevators and go all the way to the guy's room, and they were very upset about it.
How awkward was that?
I think it was more awkward for them than for us, because that's just something they're not used to in Iran, where freedom of press doesn't exist at all. to see like a government official seeing somebody like a journalist asking him tough questions inside an elevator all the way to his room. I think that's one hell of an experience he's never going to forget. But, you know, we weren't doing anything illegal. So we just, you know, we did what we had to do. And he was using his iPhone to record everything. Obviously, they were very annoyed. Every time we approached them, you know, they don't like press. They consider us as their enemies. So after a few minutes, we realized it's past 8 o'clock. So the event has probably started. We found that it's on the second floor, I believe. My colleagues asked me if we should just take the elevator and go upstairs to the second floor and see like how close we can get to the event and if there's anything we can do there. So I said, sure, let's do it. And, you know, we left our equipment behind. We just went upstairs. It was like four of us. One of our colleagues was just recording with her iPhone inside the elevator. It wasn't even, you know, she was just turning the camera on. And as soon as it hit the second floor, the elevator door opened and literally like 3 meters away to our left was the desk where they had basically set up like a identification checkpoint type thing to allow people cross it and go to the event. But it took like, I don't know, like maybe 5-6 seconds as soon as we stepped to the hallway for the security agents to sort of just physically bomb rush us, including, I mean, especially my colleague who was holding the camera. And she just said, get off of me. You can't touch me. And they were trying to grab her phone.
Can we just be clear? When you talk about security agents, are you talking about the Iranian delegation security people?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the desk where they had kind of set up shop to check IDs, I believe I could only see one American, probably Secret Service or some kind of American guard that was providing them security. Or being a referee in the middle of this whole thing. And then the rest of them was like five, maybe four or five, six Iranian agents who basically, you know, that was, they felt like that's their territory. So the American guy didn't do anything because we weren't doing anything wrong. But the Iranian agents sort of just like ran towards us like a bunch of crazy gorillas and they tried to rough up my coworker and grab her phone. She pushed them back. And then when they started scuffling around, my coworker and I kind of just like got in the middle and pushed them away. But they were very consistent. They wouldn't let go. And the American agent was very confused because, you know, he had to sort of protect them. I guess that's what he was hired to do. But at the same time, we weren't doing anything that he could, you know, do anything about it as far as like the laws go.
So how is the situation resolved?
So they were talking to themselves like, go get the phone out of her hand. I could understand, you know, they were speaking in Farsi and I was like, no, you can't. And I kept talking back in English. So the American guard would understand that what's happening here is really them crossing the line. It's not us. Sort of in my answers, I was translating what's happening. And then when they couldn't get closer to her because we were kind of protecting her, they asked the American guard to go and grab her phone. And then he kind of like looked at him surprised. He's like, I can't do that. I'm not allowed to do that. All I can do is ask them to leave and leave this floor. And he turned around. He's like, can you guys please leave the floor? And we said, sure, no problem. But that wasn't enough. They kept going after her till the elevator door opened. We went inside the elevator. And before the elevator shut, like all four or five of them, just again, like a bunch of wild gorillas came in front of the elevator door and they started filming us to intimidate us, obviously. And then basically a couple of words went back and forth. They called us traitors and this and that. And then the door closed and we went downstairs. But it was kind of crazy because it showed like these agents or professional terrorists, I would really consider them, are coming to these countries on official business on behalf of the Iranian regime. But they don't even know the laws of these lands and they don't even educate these people about like how things are very different in a place like New York and United Nations. So they just behave like they would in their own territory inside Iran. They think bullying and basically being aggressive with people and having it their way is totally okay and normal.
Well, when you look at the time that President Raisi and his delegation spent in New York, he had various engagements from his UN General Assembly speech to other events like the one you described in the hotel. how well do you think that whole trip went for Raisi and his team? Like, what is your verdict on it?
Well, you know, Raisi is very little respected in Iran. They don't even think he's got enough intelligence to write his own speeches or have any opinion of his own. He's pretty much like just the other versions of other presidents, except without the mask. He's there to be a mouthpiece for the supreme leader. So he basically went up there and he gave a speech pleasing his supreme leader. And that's all it was on that piece of paper. Basically had a couple of people that he was talking to, mainly the supreme leader. The other one was the fanatic Muslims around the world, because he started off by talking about the Quran thing and, you know, the burning of the Quran in Europe and things like that. So again, it was sort of like the Ayatollah Khomeini fatwa to the most extremist Muslims around the world, basically the terrorists. That was one of the things. And then he was sucking up a little bit to the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans when he arrogantly said the balance in the world has changed and we are the future power of this globe and this and that, which was kind of like just ridiculous. But again, he was mainly just trying to please his boss, saying, thank you for sending me to New York for a few days. And I just said everything you would have probably wanted to say up here. And that was it.
Well, Salman Arbabi, executive producer for VOA's Persian service, speaking to us from New York City. Great to have you back on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. A week after Iran allowed five Americans to return home from what the U.S. says was unjust detention, and the U.S. granted clemency to five Iranians charged with federal offenses and unfroze $6 billion of Iranian funds, there are unanswered questions about what happens next. They include what lies ahead for the five Americans returning from Iran, the three Iranians who remained in the U.S. after their clemencies, and two Iranian residents of the U.S. who remain in Iranian prisons after the deal. Barry Rosen is a founding member of the U.S. nonprofit group Hostage Aid Worldwide and was a hostage himself at the U.S. Embassy in Iran in 1979. I called Rosen by phone last Thursday and asked him another question, why he rejects the term prisoner exchange to describe what happened last week.
I'd say that the United States attempted to resolve the situation for these five Americans who were held hostage for many years, and only the Iranian Islamic Republic chose to use that terminology of prisoner exchange to somehow equalize what had been going on. The Iranian regime has taken people unlawfully detained, treated them miserably, and more than anything else, destroyed their human rights for years. So let's not kid ourselves and talk about prisoner exchange. This was not a prisoner exchange at all. The Americans who were detained and held hostage did nothing wrong, and Iran only uses this in a way to get leverage against the United States and the EU and all the Western powers.
Well, as you may know, Iran was trying to get five of its citizens who had been arrested, convicted, indicted on federal charges in the U.S. released in a kind of a five-for-five deal, but only two of those five Iranians who were granted clemency actually went back to Iran. Three remained, and they got a commutation in one case and pardons in the other two cases, but those were conditional also on those individuals maintaining good behavior. And of course, they've been through a U.S. legal system that is very different from the Iranian legal system. What is your take on that?
My take on this is that those Iranians who wanted to stay here in the United States know that it is better to live in the United States when there is justice and human rights here. Whereas if they return to Iran, who knows what would happen to them? And they know that. So that's proof, absolutely, that there's a world of difference between the United States and Iran when it comes to justice and human rights.
What are the next steps for the five Iranian Americans who came back to the U.S. earlier this week, and who in some cases endured many long years of imprisonment under very tough conditions. What kinds of challenges are they going to face in the coming weeks and months?
Well, it is my hope that the U.S. government will provide as much assistance as possible in helping to resolve whatever issues these five American citizens deserve to have. That is, if there are emotional issues or whatever involved, it's important that the United States government understands that these people need some sort of resolution to the misery that they lived under for those many years. So I think there needs to be a great deal of sensitivity, not only from the U.S. administration, but friends, family, and others, because this is a long haul and they deserve as much assistance as possible.
Well, as we also know, there are two Iranian citizens who are residents of the U.S. who are still in jail in Iran and were not included in this prisoner deal. What is Hostage Aid Worldwide doing to pursue those cases?
Well, we're attempting to keep pushing for the release of these two gentlemen, Shahab Dalili and Mr. Shahmad, because we really feel that we have to understand what is the issue here. Why are they still not being considered illegally detained?
And why do you think that is?
That is a question that I would have to keep presenting to the U.S. government. They are both American residents, so this is an issue that, for me, is an outstanding one, and I feel for both families. And we will keep pushing to find out why this is happening.
At a Hostage Aid Worldwide event in New York City on September 18th, you spoke about some of the solutions to prevent future hostage taking by Iran and other nations. What kind of multilateral solutions do you think are realistic and could make a difference?
Well, for one thing, I mean, this has been going on for a very long time, that each country deals with their own hostages and nothing has really worked in terms of deterring Iran or other nations who hold hostages. I think we need a multilateral and multi-networking approach, which calls into favor the addition of civil society. We need the UN involved, and we have sent letters for the General Secretary to deal with this issue. But most of all, we need this network to deter Iran both legally and financially, make life very difficult for Iran in this case, so that it will decide not to use their hostage diplomacy and making people suffer throughout the world. But I also would like to add that I do think that in the meantime, and this may be a very hard thing for Iranian families, that it's important for them to think about traveling to Iran is the most dangerous situation for them.
You're talking about Iranians who are in the diaspora who may want to go back to their country of origin.
Yes, dual citizens. And I really feel strongly that they need to think twice about returning to Iran for family occasions. Anything can happen at any time.
That does seem like a sound piece of advice, as challenging as it might be for those Iranians. Barry Rosen, founding member of Hostage Aid Worldwide and senior advisor to United Against Nuclear Iran, speaking to us from New York City. Thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
That's all for our program. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening, and come back next week for another Flashpoint Iran.